Yeah, thanks, Dermot, for organizing this panel and you for being here. I assume there are sitting people there, but I can't see you at all. So perhaps I'm talking to no one, I don't know. What I will do is we'll talk about our latest research, and before I will do so, I will tell you the main three conclusions. One of the reasons is I never know whether I get to the end on time, especially I heard that we have slightly less minutes than I thought we had. The second reason actually is that I want to know whether you agree with my conclusions when I show you my data. So the first conclusion I want to draw is that the self-reported well-being is really much lower in the autistic adults for approximately 50% of the adults we saw. So it's not the case for everyone. Second of all, if we look across adulthood, age is actually not a major factor for well-being in autistic adults, and I come back to that later on. It is a factor, but it's not really a large factor. Third of all, this psychological distress and also education seems to be really important factors for current well-being, but also for well-being in the near future, so 3 years from now. So we'll talk about that also a bit more, why this is the case. But first, I thought I will give you a short outline, so I will give some definitions again about well-being, because I thought perhaps people will change across the different lecture halls to go to different kind of talks, so I will repeat a bit here and talk about well-being and what do we know in aging research and in autism research, and then actually move to our work. I will focus on two studies, a cross-sectional studies, and I actually realized when I was preparing this talk that I gave a talk about this data set a couple of years ago and we didn't have time to write it up, so I felt a bit embarrassed, but we are now writing it up together with this second study, so it will be together in one paper, so we have a more overall picture there. And I come back to the conclusions later on, but when we go to the definitions, I thought most of you will know this specific ad, Live Life to the Max. And actually, when you see this ad, it's about a more hedonistic approach of life. So that is about accumulating positive experiences and reducing the negative experiences. So it's about having fun. You only live once. So this is the idea of a more hedonistic approach. But there is more to well-being. So a good health, a job, but also having friends or no friends and being happy with it, being loved or being in love, but also, and also Helen referred to this, is feeling autonomous, having a purpose in life, self-acceptance. This is all are all different aspects of well-being. So you know it's really like a multifactorial construct. There are many aspects to well-being, so it's really hard to capture this in one measure often. What we also know that there are many, many measures of well-being. If you look in well-being and psychology, there are at least 99 general measures of well-being. So that's quite a lot. And if you look at these well-being measures across the board, they seem to include 196 different dimensions of well-being. So we talk about really a multifactorial construct there. Some people talk about happiness, but here we are not talking about this temporary state. So I'm feeling happy right now. This is not what we refer to when we talk about well-being, but it's more about this general evaluation of the affective state. This was more the hedonic kind of approach, so what I was talking about when you're living your life to the max. But we are also referring to this as subjective well-being. But it's also a part of it is psychological well-being, and it's about having a good life, and it's more normative. This is more about feeling related to others, having control, mastery of your life, feeling autonomous here. The quality of life we are all referring to in these three talks is actually a combination of one and two. So this is the kind of well-being we are talking about. And there are a lot of people that we shouldn't use the term subjective well-being, but more the evaluative well-being. So in the field, many different words are used. So I decided I will just talk about well-being. So it will be a bit more simple, I hope. So what we see when we focus on aging, this is a large study. This has been done across different countries, also in not just in English-speaking countries, but I will show you this specific data. Tens of thousands of people were involved. And what you see, indeed, when you get a bit older, your happiness seems to increase. Well-being becomes a bit better. It's after you're 50, so perhaps 50 is a good cutoff here. But one of the reasons why people are often surprised about this is also that we see that pain, for example, and physical health, so pain is increasing and physical health is decreasing. And the main reason we do see this specific increase in well-being is that there is a really huge reduction in stress. People experience more mastery and autonomy when they get older. So the accent of what is important for well-being changes across the lifespan. And this stress aspect, I think it's really relevant when we also talk about autism. If we focus on autism and well-being in autistic adults, what we see in general across the board is that it's lower. We see it in self-reported, but also in other reports. We see it when we compare autistic individuals to other comparison group with all kinds of different psychiatric diagnoses, like schizophrenia or depression. It's even then it seems to be lower. And we see it in children and young adults. But where the findings are less consistent, if we focus on the factors that are actually predictive for self-reported well-being, because some studies are saying, yes, IQ is really important, early language development is really important, autism symptomatology is really important, but not all studies find that these factors are that important. Other factors, these are more internal factors related to a specific person, but can also be more external factors like employment, independent living, and support networks. So what I want to show here is that next to that it's a multifactorial construct, also many external and internal factors are relevant when we want to predict something about well-being. And if you have a multifactorial construct and also many factors influencing this multifactorial construct, it's really important to look at the interaction of all these factors. And that's why we use in our work the so-called graph network analysis, and I will show some pictures to show you what we do. So we had two goals for our studies. The first goal was to determine a self-reported well-being in older ASD adults, and to explore which internal and external factors were actually related to this self-reported well-being. And study one was important, mainly this cross-sectional study for goal one. And what we did here, we had a group of autistic adults participating between 19 and 79 years of age, and their mean age was 46 years of age, and approximately 100 of them were over 50 years of age. A lot of women were included, almost one-third. It was a well-educated group. They were all middle or highly educated. They had a lot of comorbidities. Approximately 55% had an anxiety disorder or a depression. A lot of unemployment, approximately 40% of them. So it was a group with severe difficulties. And they all had an adulthood diagnosis, which is also really important. And we compared this group to a group of adults without an autism diagnosis, approximately the same age, same gender distribution, but not the same distribution, for example, in employment or psychotropic medication use. For the second goal, we also looked at the data of study one, but we also did this accelerated longitudinal study. So approximately 1 or 2, 4 years later, we saw the group again. So the mean time interval was 3 years in this respect. And what we saw, what we had here, we had the individuals approximately 121, or actually not approximately, exactly 121. They were between 27 and 79 years of age, so their mean age was 51 at time one and 54 at time two. And more than half of them were over 50 years of age. So we needed this data set to look at these internal and external factors. And we looked at age, gender, ASD symptomatology, psychological distress, employment, living situation, relationship status, and education. So these were the factors we were looking at in this case. And what we saw when we focused on the first goal, what we see is that there is a huge difference in reported quality of life, but everyone who uses this questionnaire knows that the total score is not really a good score here, and Helen already showed her data as well, and I think we have a highly similar pattern actually, because we also see that across the board, the autism group report a lower quality of life. So it's from actually each of these four domains, so we use the standard four domains here, you see that there is a lower score. And there were quite large effect sizes, but I think it's even more interesting to see which number of this specific group of participants actually show a really low quality of life. So they were in the lowest 5%. And in the lowest 5% of this distribution was approximately 40 to 54% of this group, depending on which scale we were looking at. So it's quite a large proportion. There were also people that had a higher quality of life, but it was only 1.3%. So you see large individual differences here. When we go to the... Then the first conclusion I hope you agree with is that the self-reported well-being is lower in these autistic adults for approximately 50% of these adults. When we go to the second goal, you can also rephrase this goal a bit, because what we did is that we explore if the situation at time one relates to quality of life in time point one. And we did this, what I already said, with this graph network analysis. So what you see here is such a graph network. And what you see here are each node, so each circle you see in the screen, is a different factor. And there are lines in between, and these lines in between in this case are just the correlations above a point three. So it's just an elegant way to see a correlation matrix. So it's a so-called association network. And what you see here, for example, is the physical domain of quality of life. So just to point it out, that we are focusing on that specific domain. And here you see age. So there is a distance between age and this physical quality of life, that there is a big difference already suggests that there is not a strong relation between these two, and especially there's not a correlation above 0.3 here. You also see a green line, probably, I hope, going from age to the relationship status. That means when people are older, it's more likely that they have a relationship and that they are married in this case. When you go to this part of the graph, then you see the relationship between the different factors that are related to this physical quality of life. And COM stands for the psychological distress. So the comorbid psychological distress people experience is negatively related and quite strongly related to the well-being, the experienced well-being. There is a slight relation between the ASD symptomatology and psychological distress. So the higher the self-reported symptomatology, also the higher the psychological distress people report, but it's not directly related to quality of life. However, here you don't take into account the interaction between all the factors. You can do it in a different kind of way. That's what we call a concentration network. And here you take into account all the other correlations between the different nodes. So here again, you see this physical health, quality of life domain, and then you see that mainly psychological distress is related to physical quality of life. So based on this, it seems that psychological distress plays an important role in the overall network, but also age and gender here. And what it means in this case is that age and gender, that they don't have a relationship, but they are really central in the network, because a lot of relationships go via age and gender. And the similar pattern was found in all quality of life domains. So that's why I conclude that it's not a major factor across the lifespan, and that psychological distress is a really important factor for current well-being. When we look at the longitudinal data, then we can rephrase our goal to saying explore if the situation at time one relates to well-being at time two. So again, the same kind of graph, association network, and we directly go here to the social domain in this case. Again, age is really far away, so there is no relationship whatsoever. And you see again that psychological distress has quite a strong relation to the social domain here. If we now focus on this concentration network, a slightly different picture emerges, because education is also important. What we see is that those individuals with a higher education, so they all had a middle or high education, but those with a higher education are less satisfied with their social life, while we focus on those with a higher education, they also report less psychological distress. While psychological distress, a high amount, is again related to the social relationship domain. So here there is some interaction going on with someone's educational level. So it's important to take that into account. So here again we see that education plays an important role and gender plays an important role. And again, the similar picture emerges for all quality of life domains. The last way to my conclusions again are that it's also education is important for the near future well-being. The last way to rephrase this goal is actually to say, can the situation at time one relate to actual change over time? Can we predict whether there will be a change in quality of life over this short time frame? But there is no relationship whatsoever with any of the predictors with a quality of life change. But you can ask yourself, is there actually a quality of life change in such a short time frame? And the answer is no. There are no within time effects. There's still the same group size that have problems with quality of life. And if you take the retest reliability into account, there are some people with a slight incline. 4 to 7% of the people show an incline, and there's a small group that shows an incline in quality of life. But across the board, there is hardly any change. And this is in line with actually the theory about well-being and aging, that this so-called set point theory. Our quality of life and our happiness is really stable across our lifespan. So there are some challenges here. It was a really intelligent, well-educated group with mostly adulthood diagnosis, so it might not be true for everyone, but even in this well-educated group, education really matters. We didn't include the old group, people over 80, so it might be that a slightly different picture emerges. And we always have the difficulty with a healthy survivor effect. I can always dive into that later on. But there are also factors we don't take into account that might influence our model. And I think there is a strong clinical implication here that treating psychological distress might increase well-being. I said might be because I didn't test it, but actually I would like to say that I'm pretty sure that it will have an effect on quality of life when we can do something about psychological distress. So you already saw my conclusions, but some of you that might paid attention to some of the details saw that I had these two quotation marks around conclusions, and that is because it's our preliminary conclusions. I really would like my co-authors to check all my analysis, so that's one reason. And the second thing I didn't answer really is this question, do people actually become happier? I said age didn't have a huge effect, which is true, but if we do the same as what Helen did, compare the older group with the younger group, the older group has a slightly higher quality of life. It's actually also significant, but if you look at the actual difference, it's really not a meaningful difference. It is within the regular range. So I would say no, but it's also true for everyone without autism. So with this perhaps a bit pessimistic note, I want to end. So I want to thank my former lab members and current lab members, and especially those that were involved in the current study, and I want to thank you for your attention.